accession number 20497, Reel 1.
Richard Jones, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
I was born at a little village called Graiseley, outside Reading, with a population, I should think, of about 250 people.
This is Berkshire?
In Berkshire, that is correct.
Which year was this?
I was born on the 28th of December, 1918.
You were telling me that neither of your parents were English.
My father actually was Welsh. He was pretty absolutely pure Welsh from North Wales and from Llanberis in that area. And my mother was Danish.
And you also have a story, I think, about an unusual middle name.
That is correct. My second name, my initials are R.L., and my second name is Leo Line, spelt L-E-O-L-I-N-E. And there's a history behind that. My mother, my father wanted to call me Llewellyn, which is L-L-E-W-E-L-Y-N. And unfortunately, my mother, who always to her dying day swore she hadn't an accent, had great difficulty in pronouncing Llewellyn. In fact, she couldn't do it. So Leoline, as we are led to believe, is the nickname for Llewellyn, as Dick is to Richard in England. And from that day onwards, I have found it most convenient, because with a name like Jones, you can, with bank accounts and various other things, come across problems. So I always sign my name R. Leoline Jones, and I've never had any further trouble with the bank or anything since.
Which part of Denmark did your mother come from?
My mother came from the area south, which was Lolland.
Can you tell me the story of your education, please?
My education, that I started school at about 7 and went to a little small school in Reading. I then left when I was about 9 and went to a preparatory school and didn't do very well. And then I was sent to a boarding school in Birmingham. And the reason for all these changes I learned afterwards, because unfortunately I was dyslexic. And of course, in the days, in those days, in the early 20s and things, dyslexia in the schools by the masters was not accepted as a normal handicap. And unfortunately, when the rest of the form went forward, we were usually left behind and we never really picked very much up. And then at 14, I went to a boarding school again. And while I was there, I joined the OTC and thoroughly enjoyed it. But at the age of about 16, my father was told that I would never, ever, as far as I can gather, pass an exam, so I was taken away. And that really is the extent of my school education.
What did you do on leaving school?
When I left school, I felt, I knew I was practical and I could do virtually anything in the practical line altogether, and decided the only way was to start right at the bottom. And I started off in one of the general stores, the biggest in Oxford, in those days called Ellison and Cavill, and I started off in the furniture department and thoroughly enjoyed it. But I started right at the bottom with a starting salary of 5 shillings a week. I found all the managers and all the staff extremely good, and I thoroughly enjoyed doing what I did. You knew what you were doing and you were being trained. and I found that I had the correct personality to be able to get on with customers, which of course was paramount in a selling experience. After I'd been there, when I was about 17 and a half, the RAF were advertising for people to train as pilots in the RAF Volunteer Reserve, because the problems of a war with Germany were beginning to arise on the surface. So I went for an interview in Reading with the RAF Volunteer Reserve, and when it got to the on the interview, it got to the state of education. I notified them that I'd been in the Officers Training Corps, and as far as I was concerned, they accepted it, and I didn't hear any more about that. So, and I passed the medical with flying colours, and I never had any experience in the training in flying. As far as I was concerned, it was second nature and came absolutely automatically without any problem whatsoever.
So this was in 37?
That was in, yes, it would be early 38, early 1938. And I started off on Miles Magister aircraft at Woodley Aerodrome in Reading. And on my very first flight, I can remember getting in the front cockpit, and I saw a little notice on the dashboard, note, this aircraft will not repeat, will not come out of a spin. So I realized then that one had to know what was going on, but it didn't worry me. And very shortly afterwards, they did change on the Magister, and from that date onwards you were able to do full training and spinning and everything else.
Did you find it easy to learn how to fly?
I found no problems whatsoever. I had a very good instructor, and he was an old, well, when I say old, to me he was old, he's probably about 50, sergeant pilot called Sergeant Dudley. And we got, I can remember going solo in approximately 7 or 8 hours flying, and thoroughly enjoyed everything else. And on after I'd been on the Magister for approximately possibly 6 months or so, we were transferred to Hawker Hearts, which had a Merlin Kestrel engine, and the variants were Hawker Hart, Audax, and Hawker Hart, Audax, and I've forgotten the other one. But very, very good experience. But they were biplanes, and I'd done quite a few hours on the biplanes, which were even in those days operational, which gave me good stead in the time to come. Then the war came along, and we were immediately flying stopped, and we were hanging about for a few months waiting to go to a training station. I was with others. My station that I went to was RAF Turnhill in Shropshire. And we were then on, the aircraft we trained on was North American Harvards. And the Harvard was an extremely good aircraft to train on. It did have little tendencies at times on which kept you very much alive. And we found that when we were flying the Harvard, and we went through everything from training, dive bombing, night flying and everything, that where you had the aircraft where you really had to watch it at times, it produced a very good pilot, because you always gave thought to its condition of flying. Whereas sometimes where you were flying aircraft which had virtually no odds at all, which I could almost say flew itself. You took people and pilots used to take it for granted, do things they shouldn't be doing, and unfortunately I used to see them coming to grief, whereas on a machine that had little problems occasionally, and you were always ready to rectify them, and you produced a very good standard of pilot. That worked very well. We had finished that course. I passed out with a good standard from there, and got posted in early in 1940 to an operational training unit at Aston Down in Gloucestershire, and we were straight away put onto Spitfires. And of course, with a Spitfire, you had to learn up exactly what to do, because there was no dual or anything else. And the first time you took off in a Spitfire, you were on your own. I can remember the first time I went off, we used to start off at about 6 a.m, and it was perfectly all right. I took off, and by the time I'd got the undercarriage up and everything organized, I found I was in cloud. Hadn't got a clue where I was going, but luckily it was thin cloud and came out on top. All went well. I did about an hour's flying, came down, and I think I did approximately 15 hours flying on a Spitfire before being posted to an operational squadron in London.
Just before we go on to the operational squadron, when you joined the RAFVR pre-war, had you thought that a war was coming?
We had got pretty good knowledge that everybody, the Hitler Youth and the Hitler regime, Nazi Germany, was becoming very much in mind. And if I remember right, I can't remember his name now, that the Prime Minister at the time,
Neville Chamberlain,
that's correct, was on the radio saying that he'd got an undertaking from Hitler which meant peace in our time. But frankly, from then onwards, I think we realised that something was bound to happen fairly shortly, and we were being trained for it. And thank goodness we were. And as far as I was concerned, the people that joined as volunteers, I have seen recent examples in the newspapers that they were being picked mainly from public schools and universities, but from my experience and the flying school that I was at, which was number 8 at Woodley in Reading, they came from all avenues of life, and mainly people. I remember we were attached to the Phillips aircraft factory in Woodley. And the number of their people in the factory, engineers, carpenters and what have you, who joined us, were from all walks of life. And I would say the percentage of public school, and here I'm not running down public school at all, and I had the greatest respect for them, but everybody, it wasn't just public school, it was literally every type of person, and the morale and the spirit was absolutely exceptional. And the very feeling was that if there was trouble, we were there to do our very best.
What kind of school was your school?
I actually went from one school to a public school, and I must admit I didn't enjoy it at all, because from a point of view of learning and being dyslexic, I felt out of things. But apart from that, I will say that the people I met and the people I was with were extremely good, extremely kind, and I have contacts and friends with them today. But it was just the fact that I knew I was wasting my time, because I was unable to get anywhere at the time because of dyslexia.
What was the name of the school?
That was Bromsgrove School in Worcestershire.
Now, you were just about to tell me about going to an operational squadron, please.
That's right. Rather interesting. When I was still at Aston Down, there was a notice put on the notice board that there were vacancies, that they were waiting for pilots to various places, and one of the places was RAF Kemble, which wasn't too far away, which we thought was quite a doddle. So three of us put our name down to go to Kemble. Unfortunately, we were then posted straight away to RAF Kenley, which was near Croydon in London, because unfortunately it was a typographical error and it should have been Kenley, but it had been printed as Kemble. We found ourselves then, we went straight away. This was at the beginning, the very beginning of the Battle of Britain. I was posted to 64 Squadron, and the commanding officer was Squadron Leader A.R. Donald MacDonnell. In his latter years, he was the head of the Glengarry clan in Scotland. And from our point of view and mine, he was an exceptional man. He understood human nature, he got the best out of us, and he gained something which, as far as I am concerned, is all important in a position like that. We all respected him. When we arrived, we had no experience whatsoever on operational flying. We had had a certain amount of dogfighting, you name it, and we could fly the machine, but not under operation conditions. Straight away, he introduced us to all the squadron, and he called us his chicks. And in those days, a squadron had three states of readiness. One was 30 minutes, when you could not be on the aerodrome, you could be in the mess or go to the local pictures, where if you were called up to 15 minutes, they could drive you straight back. The next one was 15 minutes, where you were in the crew room on the aerodrome waiting for any emergency that could come. And the final one was readiness, where you were virtually sitting in the machine waiting to start your engines and away. But while you were on 15 minutes, the thing we most feared of all, believe it or not, was a telephone. Because invariably, any bad news, whether the enemy was approaching and in what numbers or what have you, was always on the telephone. So as soon as the telephone bell rang, everybody was alert, waiting for it, and then you suddenly heard the chap say, yes, okay, this and that, and it was probably nothing to do with flying whatsoever, so we all relaxed again. So, but we were in permanent tension. When we did get a readiness call, it would be, we'll say, Angels 2-5 or 2-20,000. That was at 20,000 feet where the enemy were approaching. And we'd take off immediately. We reckoned to get off from starting the motors within about 3 minutes. And there were usually two squadrons on a station. And in Kenley at that time, there was one Hurricane squadron and one Spitfire squadron. And we took off and immediately climbed to wherever we were going, and we're always very, very careful to make certain that we were looking into the sun, because if the enemy appeared in the sun, it was very, very difficult to see them. Another point here, people often ask me, were you frightened? I think if we are honestly true with one another, I won't say we are frightened. Perhaps we were, but we always had, most people, I certainly did, what today you'd class as butterflies in your stomach. And as soon as you got to near where they were going, you could hear on your radio sometime the German language coming from their fighters and all the rest, and immediately you were put on alert. And I won't say it was fright, but it was fear. But as soon as you got into battle, in a dogfight or anything like that, and you had to defend yourself, all fear and butterflies disappeared. I suppose the adrenaline took over, and frankly, it was them or us, and you had no intention of being you. Having got this far, I must point out, as far as squadron leader Mac Donnell was concerned, as soon as we arrived, he realized that we hadn't had a lot of experience. And we were immediately on 50, on when we were on 30 minutes, he immediately arranged for us at every opportunity to come under the wing of a more experienced pilot, whether it be a sergeant pilot, an officer pilot, didn't make any difference. We all had a fantastic understanding when we were on the aerodrome, and to my mind, there was never any distinction between the two when we were flying. And we used to go up, dogfight, dogfight, and more dogfighting, and put us through the conditions that we would meet when we were in action against the enemy. And this was, there's no doubt about it, it was absolutely brilliant, and it was the finest thing that ever happened, and Donald Mac Donnell realized that this was essential. And I consider that, as far as I was concerned and the others with me, it not only lengthened life expectancy, but in many cases it survived us. In other words, we survived the battle as a result of this. And another point that we used to encounter in the early days, when I first went there, the squadrons used to fly in formation in VIX of three. We'll say there were 9 aircraft on duty. Most squadrons had 16 aircraft, but it didn't follow that 16 took off, because you either had aircraft shot down, you had they were unserviceable and being worked on. I suppose the average would be about 9 or 10, possibly maximum, and they used to fly in VIX of 3. But of course, if you went through cloud and came out at the other side, you were a sitting target for the enemy. And I remember Donald Mac Donnell always said, right, whenever we go out, we spread ourselves out so that it is difficult. We are not clumped together, so the enemy it's difficult for the enemy, and it is also gives us a chance to get ourselves organized if we see the enemy. I think that is one of the main things, and I definitely owe my life, I think, to the fact that I was under a very good squadron leader who we all respected. And here again, I suppose I can't speak from experience, because it never happened, but I have no doubt that I was lucky. I was under an extremely good squadron leader, and of course I cannot talk for other squadrons, but I feel certain that the efficiency of squadrons did, up to a point, depend on the caliber of the people that commanded the squadron.
You say that you joined the squadron at the beginning of the battle. Can you tell me, please, of any incidents that you had in the air against the enemy?
As far as I was concerned, we got up to the height, we'll say 20,000 feet over Tenterden or Hawkhurst or Dover, something like that. And you could see, well, as soon as you saw the bombers or the fighters, people would immediately shout where they were to give everybody, and invariably we were above them at times, and people say, well, how did you attack the enemy aircraft? I was on Spitfires, and in the main, we went after the fighter escorts, and the Hurricanes went after the bombers. But from my experience, I found that as soon as you met the enemy, it wasn't a matter of what you went for, or whether it was bombers or fighters. Everything was happening so fast. You got in a dogfight, and the main thing was organization disappeared. It was every man for himself. If you saw a fighter in your sights, you had a go at it. And with a bomber, for preference, you attacked it from above and dived down on it, and then very rapidly got out of its way from its guns. And it was a most extraordinary feeling. For the first week or so, I considered it was the most amazing. Things were happening so fast. One moment you're in the middle of everything, shooting to the best of your ability at aircraft. And my motto in those days, you never, if you shot at an aircraft, you never under any circumstances looked at it to see what had happened. The main thing was that if you wasted time looking to see what happened, a 109 German aircraft would possibly be on your tail or coming out of the sun. So the main thing was to keep moving, go after things, and then suddenly you'd find everybody, the whole sky was clear, it was all over, it was all going so fast. I suppose the average speed in a dive with us was 350 and above, and you can imagine that if the other chap's going in the opposite direction, things move very rapidly, and you suddenly found you're on your own, and you came home.
Were you aware of hitting any enemy aircraft?
This is a point that, from my experience, I'm talking in the early days, that yes, I was opening fire on people, and do bear in mind that our guns were aligned to have maximum firepower from each of the four guns on each wing at approximately 250 yards. It was very, very seldom that you got as near or closer than that quickly, or to judge it, things were happening faster. If you saw things, you fired at it and spread it a little bit by left and right rudder, and I feel absolutely convinced that I did quite considerable amount of damage. But I here and now cannot say whether I shot anything down or damaged anything. I consider I damaged quite a few planes, and during the whole battle, I felt that I had been instrumental in shooting down about 2 to 2.5 or 3 enemy aircraft. But having said, as I just did, that having seen your ammunition causing damage to an aircraft, an enemy aircraft, you couldn't, I never stayed behind to see what had happened, because I have heard of certain other people and friends of mine who were used to look out, had we destroyed it, and follow it down and all the rest of it, but unfortunately they were probably pounced on by somebody else. So my motto was, get in, do the damage. Don't waste time seeing what damage you've done. If there's anything else around, have a go for it. And I feel quite certain that I must have put the fear of God up many, many German pilots. I only hope that I put far more fear of God up them than they put up me. And taking it all round, I consider myself extremely lucky.
Were you aware of causing much disruption to their bomber streams?
Yes, because the bombers used to come over in formation. And providing we weren't tackled by the fighters in advance, the main thing was, as soon as you saw the bombers, it was more or less every man for himself, and we went straight and dived for the bombers, straight from above, with the idea always you attacked the one that was more or less furthest away from anybody else. The main idea, or if that didn't happen, the main idea was to shoot up somebody on the outside, hoping that he would break away. And invariably he did break away, and then you tried to shoot him down. And the other occasion, that if they were coming toward you and you are only a few aircraft and you hadn't got height advantage or anything else, it sounds risky, but the best way was probably to go straight for them, head on, firing hell for leather into them from the front, and invariably the German ranks always broke before you did. That was a blessing, actually. And then any stragglers, you did the same, you went for the straggler, hoping to shoot him down.
Why should they invariably have broken before you did?
I think I can only assume that they realised it was a Spitfire. I think they had a very great respect for British fighters, more so than they ever thought they would have. And if you have 8 machine guns firing straight at you, the obvious thing is to try and manoeuvre